Today is Monday, March 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis, and coming up...
This week we've seen how African nations and Western nations have worked together to share tactical skills, how to secure a perimeter, how to provide medical assistance to people who've been hurt, and we've also seen how they've shared operational command insight.
That's VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. We'll have more on this story coming up. Also, we'll have the latest on Venezuela. And the United States-supported forces continue their assault on the last area of land claimed by the Islamic State group in Syria. It's all on today's International Edition. Venezuelan opposition leader and U.S.-recognized interim president Juan Guaido arrived at the Caracas airport today as demonstrations in support of him were taking place. Guaido announced his return on Twitter, telling his followers that he had passed immigration at the airport in his beloved land. Ahead of his return from a tour of Latin American allies, Guaido had called on the Venezuelan people to gather in cities across the country to show their support for him. And joining me in the studio today is Brian Padden, VOA a senior analyst. And thank you for joining me for more on Guaido's return to Venezuela. So was this a risky return for him? What are observers saying about this?
It was a very risky return. The Maduro government had let it be known that Guaido, if he returned, after he was banned from traveling outside the country, he would face possible arrest. Also, he could be charged with trying to undermine the government by trying to coordinate the shipments of aid from overseas and meeting with foreign governments as the self-proclaimed head of the state. So there's still a lot of legal jeopardy for him within the country. He was not arrested today at the airport. He now heads to when he landed today in Caracas just minutes ago. He now will head into the city center for a massive anti-government rally to again call for the ouster of socialist leader Nicolas Maduro. It's unclear if he would be arrested at a later time or how the Maduro government would react. There's a lot of international pressure on the Maduro government, urging them not to arrest Guaido or else face further, perhaps sanctions or other condemnation from the international community.
And also, so if he does have the support of the international community, then is he confident, Guaido?
Guaido has the support of about 50 countries right now who recognize his self-proclaimed interim presidency of Venezuela because he is the highest-ranking elected leader. If you accept the opposition's claim that Maduro's re-election last year was illegitimate because he banned most major opposition parties from running.
And also, what are Maduro's supporters saying? For instance, I understand that many in the military, they're deserting because their families are suffering from hunger. So what are his supporters saying?
Well, the opposition-led campaign was supposed to be this very swift and powerful kind of surge of internal protests and international pressure to get the Venezuelan military leadership to turn against Maduro, to oust him, and allow free and fair elections to follow. That has not quite happened, despite U.S. sanctions on its lucrative oil industry, despite the mounting protests at home, despite the whole confrontation last week over shipments of aid from the U.S. through Brazil and Colombia. There have been about 100 perhaps mid-level military leadership who have kind of moved over to the opposition side. But for the most part, the leadership and the military remains firmly behind Maduro, indicating this could be a long, hard struggle to oust the the socialist leader.
Okay, thank you so much. That's VOA senior analyst Brian Patton, who is following this story and will keep us updated on developments. Well, United States-supported forces continue their assault on the last area of land claimed by the Islamic State group in Syria. VOA regional correspondent Heather Murdoch is in eastern Syria, approaching the town of Baghouz, the scene of the fighting. The Syrian Democratic Forces are trying to oust the last Islamic State forces from Baghouz. But women and children are caught in the conflict, often unsure of who to trust. My colleague Mario Ritter Jr. asked Heather Murdoch about the civilian cost of the conflict.
Do you know of any civilians left in the combat zone? Is anything being done to ensure their safety?
Today we heard about some civilians, and by civilians they mean women and children, that are still left in the combat zone. And the internationally backed Syrian forces said they were going to slow down their assault to try to get those people out. It is reasonable to assume that those people stayed not necessarily by choice, but there has been a safe corridor for people to come out, and women and children have all been brought to camps for the past few weeks. I can speculate as to why they stayed, and I would assume that has something to do with the fact that people who are left in what is basically a small refugee camp, but they're not even in the town, are the most passionate supporters of the militant group.
What are you hoping to find in the near future about the condition of women and children, and also what the Syrian Democratic Forces are trying to accomplish to finally defeat ISIS?
In terms of the women and children that have come out of this tragedy, I think what is necessary is much, much larger than something an individual camp should do. I think it has to do with what the governments of Syria and Iraq and the international community should be looking at, which is how to reintegrate this population of people that was with the Islamic State group and in many ways supported them, how for the people to live together. A lot of the people that could possibly be reintegrated into society, like children, are outcasts in many ways and potentially are facing long years in a camp, which could even increase the extremism and fester their anger over the fact that their fathers have died, and the outside world says, in a way, they're not supposed to mourn their fathers because their fathers were terrorists. I think this is fostering the next generation of extremists, and I hope that the world takes note and tries to find some solution to this very difficult problem. In terms of the military, I don't see any way around Syria existing other than defeating a group militarily like Islamic State. In terms of allowing the women and children that are coming out of ISIS territory to feel safe, it's not obvious to them, as it might be obvious to us, that the forces that are rescuing them are safer than the forces that they came from. So even children were saying that they were scared to be in the camp. And that is not because they've been abused in any way, because they said that also was true. They hadn't been abused, but because they had been told that the Syrian Democratic Forces were a dangerous group, and they had lived in a town that was under attack from the Syrian Democratic Forces. So they're scared of them, and they still believe that the Islamic State protected them. So this is sort of a dangerous thing for the future, that people are so separate that they're looking at different groups as terrorist groups, very separately without coming together and just discussing it.
That was my colleague Mario Ritter Jr. speaking with VOA regional correspondent Heather Murdoch, reporting from Syria. Well, the head of the U.S. House Judiciary Committee plans to issue requests for documents today to 60 people, including officials at the White House and the Justice Department, as part of stepped-up investigations of President Donald Trump and his connections to Russia during the 2016 presidential campaign. Representative Gerald Nadler said the committee wants to see documents from Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr., and Alan Weisselberg, the chief financial officer of the Trumpet Organization, the president's business empire. Among the top stories in the world, the chief financial officer for China tech giant Huawei is suing the Canadian government, its border security agency, and the National Police Force for rights violations. Algerians reject concessions by President Bouteflika as anti-government protests continue. And Qatar's foreign minister appeared upbeat today about a successful conclusion of negotiations his country is hosting between the U.S. and the Taliban to help find a political settlement to the war in Afghanistan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study in the journal Science suggests there may be very few small Kuiper Belt objects. The Kuiper Belt is an almost 3 billion kilometer wide ring of rocks left over from the creation of the solar system. A Southwest Research Institute-led team of scientists studied photos and data captured during the 2015 flyby of Pluto and its largest moon, Charon, by NASA's New Horizons spacecraft. Their analysis revealed that a lack of craters measuring between 91 meters to 1.6 kilometers on Charon must also indicate that any impacting objects smaller than that may also be rare. The study's lead author, Kelsey Singer of the SWRI, said that a lack of small Kuiper Belt objects indicates the formation and/or evolution of the Kuiper Belt were somewhat different than the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The United States military's largest counterterrorism exercise on the African continent wrapped up this past Friday. The two-week U.S.-led event brought together 2,000 military personnel from more than 30 African and Western nations. Our VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb visited Camp Zagre on the edge of Burkina Faso's capital, Ouagadougou, where she took an inside look into these counterterror operations.
This week, we've seen how African nations and Western nations have worked together to share tactical skills, how to secure a perimeter, how to provide medical assistance to people who've been hurt. And we've also seen how they've shared operational command insight. This training in Burkina Faso comes as the country is battling an insurgency of several Al-Qaeda-linked groups. I spoke to one Burkinabe officer, and he told me the insurgency was like a toxin to his country. The U.S. ambassador to Burkina Faso, also, Andrew Young, told VOA that the situation, the threat was getting worse. And I spoke with Major General Marcus Hicks. He's the commander of Special Operations Forces on the continent. And he was very frank about the counterterror war in West Africa.
I would tell you at this time, we are not winning. The larger group of Western liberal democracies and those who seek to be democracies and struggle with the transition to democracy and aspire to be democracies are not winning against the Salafist threat.
And all this as the Pentagon has announced that they are cutting military personnel on the continent by 10%. The first round of those cuts have already happened. They cut between 100 and 200 military personnel from West Africa. Major General Hicks says he would not recommend cutting troops further.
That was VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb reporting from Camp Zagre on the edge of Burkina Faso's capital, Ouagadougou. Well, more than 100 migrants broke into the dock area of the port of Calais in France late Saturday, and at least 50 of them attempted to race on board a cross-channel ferry that had arrived from Dover, England. Official sources say at least 48 of the refugees were caught, dashing their hopes of reaching Britain on the vessel's return trip. The French news agency AFP put the number of arrests at 63. French law enforcement took the detained migrants to the Calais police headquarters. Two of the migrants fell into the water but were quickly rescued. Maritime officials say ferry traffic was delayed for more than 12 hours as police searched the ship. AFP reported that police were continuing to look Sunday morning for at least four more migrants the police believed were still hiding out on the same ship where the other migrants had been apprehended. Well, human rights advocates are calling for an end to the discrimination that denies children with disabilities the same right to an equal education and other opportunities available to other children. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA in Geneva, where the UN Human Rights Council is holding a special session on the empowerment of children with disabilities.
In keeping with the theme of the day, the UN has made the council chamber wheelchair accessible, has hired a sign interpreter for the hearing impaired, and has embossed some oral statements in Braille. With these accommodations to children with disabilities, the UN is sending a message that it practices what it preaches. It is saying children with disabilities will be able to lead a full and fulfilling life on a par with other children if certain adaptations are made to their needs. However, the United Nations reports the sad reality is that 93 million children with disabilities around the world are likely to have their rights violated from the moment they are born. It says millions of these children are torn from their families and placed in institutions where they are at risk of violence, abuse, and neglect. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet is a medical doctor and a pediatrician. In her practice, she says she quickly learned the voices of disabled children too often go unheard.
While preparing for today, I was remembering when I just started to be a pediatrician how people will leave the situation of children with disabilities. It was much more complicated. People denied, people hide those children. They will put them sort of in boxes so they won't really be able to develop. They will speak, even doctors, in front of these children, like if they didn't hear, that they didn't exist.
Experts debating the issue agree children with disabilities must be provided with an education on an equal basis with all children. They consider this a crucial step toward their empowerment and the realization of other key rights. They say the empowerment of children with disabilities also depends upon the implementation of laws, policies, and measures to tackle harmful social norms and protect them from discrimination, stigma, and abuse. High Commissioner Bachelet says children with disabilities are among the most likely to be left behind and the least likely to be heard. She says they have the right to raise their voices and to be heard in decisions affecting their lives. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA's International Edition.
Hello, I'm Lino Mudu, host of Health Chat. Tuesday on Health Chat, we will discuss rare diseases, a group of disorders that affect about 350 million people around the world and are difficult to diagnose. Our guest is Chika Dunio, Director of Education Programs with the U.S. National Organization for Rare Disorders. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Chat, this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, artists James Turrell and Sudeika Nzinga Turrell have been on a long quest to explore their identity and express it in their art. The approach comes naturally to them as both are descendants of Africans who were brought to America and sold as slaves. Faiza Elmsmazri visited their latest exhibit, Born at the Bottom of the Ship, in the Center for the Arts in Manassas, Virginia. Faith Lapidus narrates.
Through a collection of artworks rich in vibrant colors and traditional African references, James Turrell and his wife, Sudeika Nzinga Turrell, are going beyond visual delight. They're expressing their identity. Since early childhood, Nzinga Turrell says, the questions of who am I and where did I come from were puzzling ones for the artists.
I remember when I was a sophomore in high school, they gave an assignment to trace back your lineage. So the white kids were able to get up and talk about hundreds of years of their background. And it was me and one other black kid in the class who could go back to a plantation in Virginia, and that's it.
That's the inspiration behind the exhibit.
My people were brought here on the bottom of a ship, and they were sold, and they were renamed. My dad's side of the family took the last name of the job that they had, which is butlers. My mom's side of the family took the last name of the plantation that owned them. And so I am not just Nigerian now. I am not just Ghanaian now. I am a combination of things.
Over the generations, Africans became African Americans with a new culture, and she reflects that in her art.
So you'll see a lot of things that remind people of like African prints and African textiles, but you'll also see things that are reminiscent of American culture and American print and textile.
Such as in Hope and Grace, a painting of two women wearing colorful dresses with distinctive African patterns.
They have these big afros, so it could be 1960, it could be 2018. I feel like there's an embodiment with them of all of the different cultures.
James Terrell's style is more abstract. His images are broken by vertical and diagonal lines, as in Mamiwata, the first piece visitors see in the new exhibit.
Mamiwata is a goddess of the sea. The line work, I tried to make it indicative of like the tribal aspect, but also showing that it's a dark time, dark period. There's no light going through. There's not a lot of color being seen as opposed to the other ones. So it's just showing the time of slaves being brought to America.
Terrell's work reflects how he sees himself as an African American.
Trying to be uplifting, like uplifting poses, and not bow down. They're standing strong. The lines are to symbolize the fact that people say that our race has been broken, but I say that we've been put back together and we're stronger as a people. The different colors represent the fact that we come from different backgrounds, but yet we all come together and we're still together to form a particular person or a particular feeling.
Gallery director Jordan Exum says all exhibit goers can relate to that.
A lot of us in America, you know, immigration is part of a lot of families' history and stories. So I do think it's a relevant theme. It's a universal theme. I don't think it just relates to the African-American community.
But it does have a special resonance for some visitors, like Kevin Seeger-Cottoms.
When I first walked in, the colors and the shapes hit me first because I'm a mathematician, and I love the geometry of the shapes and how they all fit together. Many things in this country are drawn from a European perspective, which I have nothing against. But it's nice to be able to walk and like see my aunt, my cousin, my mom, my dad, to see different people that I relate to in the artwork.
The artists hope to take their exhibit on tour across America and around the world. For writer Faiza El-Masri in Manassas, Virginia, Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Thank you, Faith. Here in the U.S., authorities in Alabama are searching for survivors after powerful tornadoes swept through the state, killing at least 23 people yesterday. Local authorities said at least two tornadoes touched down during an outbreak of severe weather across the southeast. The death toll could rise as rescue teams search through debris. Rita Smith, spokeswoman for the Lee County Emergency Management Agency, said about 150 first responders were involved in searching through debris after the storms hit. She said numerous homes were destroyed or damaged in Beauregard, about 95 kilometers east of Montgomery, the state capital. President Donald Trump says he has told the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, to give A-plus treatment to Alabama in the wake of the tornadoes. You've been listening to International Edition, and you can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, John Dryden. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.